Good evening, everyone, and welcome to today's program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during a Q&A session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing star then one on your touch-tone phone, and you may withdraw yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Please note today's call is being recorded, and I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the program over to Shira Dubitsky. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Elise, and good evening, everyone. Welcome to Sharsheret's national teleconference, Take Control, Navigating the Emotional Roller Coaster of Cancer. You can listen to the presentation by phone by dialing 800-895-0198 and using the code Sharsheret. We have many women calling from states all across the country who share similar concerns and questions about the emotional roller coaster of cancer. Again, I am Shira Dubitsky. I am the Director of Navigation and Support Services for Sharsheret. I'd also like to thank Shira Kravitz, who organized this evening's event, and really want to thank her for really putting together such a wonderful teleconference. Before we begin, I would like to extend a big thank you to the Julius and Emmy Hamburger Memorial Fund for generously supporting tonight's program. It's very rewarding to partner with those who see the value in the kind of support that Sharsheret offers. For those of you who are not as familiar with Sharsheret, our mission is here on this slide, and we are a national not-for-profit organization supporting young Jewish women and their families facing breast cancer or ovarian cancer. And our mission is to offer a community of support to women of all Jewish backgrounds diagnosed with breast cancer or ovarian cancer or at an increased genetic risk by fostering culturally relevant individualized connections with a network of peers and health professionals and related resources. Our expertise happens to be in Jewish women and young women. However, we are eager to support all women and families reaching out to Sharsheret for support. As I just mentioned, our expertise is in the concerns and needs of Jewish women. And so we get phone calls from women all across the Jewish spectrum who have different backgrounds. But what we have seen is that there are a lot of commonalities all across the spectrum. And so I just wanted to briefly highlight some of the concerns and issues that we're hearing about that really relate to the emotional impact of a cancer diagnosis. So first of all, as many of you know, that in the general population, those in the general population have a 1 in 345 people carry the BRCA mutation. For those of Ashkenazi Jewish descent, that number is 1 in 40. So we can certainly imagine the amount of questions that we're receiving about genetics that have to do with, anxieties around testing, anxieties around decision-making, how to share information with family members. So there's certainly a lot of emotional issues that we're dealing with in terms of genetics. Another thing that we are seeing is that there is a shared value system across the Jewish spectrum. And one of those things has to do with the fact that the family is the center of the Jewish community. And that's a wonderful thing because we see that the community is really rallying around the woman and her family to offer support when she is openly disclosing her diagnosis. They're getting meals and rides to treatment and caregiver relief and childcare relief. But like most extended families, that sometimes the community can be intrusive and, women are calling to try to figure out how to manage that. Also, for women who, let's say, want to continue growing their family or to begin growing their family, to be in a community that values families so much, you can imagine how difficult it is for that woman who may not be able to grow her family naturally and may need to look at in vitro fertilization or adoption or surrogacy. Also, the holidays, there is a range of emotional experience there as well. So, you know, people say that they feel inspired by holidays, but sometimes it can also be very painful, you know, to be facing a holiday. And certainly even logistically, that for those women who are used to hosting holidays themselves, to have to maybe delegate that for the year because either they're recovering from surgery or continuing with treatment, it's another reminder of the impact of the cancer. Certainly, we get a lot of emotional phone calls from single women who, you know, want to know what it's like to go out there in the dating world with a history of cancer or a history of a genetic mutation. So we're dealing with that, and sometimes that can be very isolating. Certainly with marriage, you know, that they're trying, many of the women are trying to have to tinker with the relationship because obviously the spouse or partner is also feeling the impact as well. At this point, I'd like to introduce Dr. Karen Hurley. She is a licensed clinical psychologist specializing in hereditary cancer risk. She received her AB in psychology from Bryn Mawr College in 1983 and her PhD in clinical psychology from Temple University in 1998. She spent 8 years on faculty at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center conducting NCI-funded research on patient decision-making about prophylactic surgery and other psychosocial issues relevant to familial cancer. She is now in private practice in New York City with adjunct faculty appointments at Memorial Sloan Kettering, Teachers College, Columbia University, and City College of New York. She has provided psychotherapy and consultation to over 400 individuals and couples and families who have to deal with the BRCA mutations, Lynch syndrome, and other forms of hereditary cancer. In addition, Dr. Hurley has conducted numerous professional education seminars and patient workshops for hospitals, professional organizations, and for people in the community affected by cancer and cancer risk. She is a member of several national advisory boards, including Sharsheret's own medical advisory board, which we are very grateful for, as well as FORCE, Bright Pink, and the cancer community, the Cancer Support Community's Breast Cancer Registry. In 2014, she received a Spirit of Empowerment Individual Commitment Award at the 8th Annual FORCE Conference in recognition of her work on behalf of the hereditary cancer community. Dr. Hurley?
Oh, thank you so much for having me and for the opportunity to support your very important work. So if we could go to our first slide. I was asked to speak about cancer being a roller coaster, and we hear that description often. And, you know, starting with that moment when you hear your diagnosis, it is kind of looking straight down a hill. I thought this picture really captured it very nicely. And, you know, there's so many things that make that a very apt metaphor, the way that going through treatment gets your hopes up one day, plunging you into disappointment the next when it looks like maybe a treatment is working, winding up on a track that you can't get off of, winding up on this track of appointment after appointment. And also, there are the strong emotions that go along with this that also feel like a roller coaster. And these are emotions that feel outside of the range of our normal everyday experience. And so there's so much of the cancer experience that that feels outsized and out of control. Perhaps if we could go to the next slide, perhaps one of the sharpest drops that really puts a twist in your stomach is when nothing turns out to be definitely something. You know, earlier, Sheryl, you were, you know, talking about the statistics for carrying a BRCA mutation, so much of cancer experience is expressed in numbers. 1 in 9, 1 in 45, 1 in 100. It can be pretty isolating when it turns out that you're that one. It can be especially frustrating if you feel like you've been doing everything right and you get a diagnosis anyway, or it could be upsetting equally so if you are somehow blaming yourself for winding up being that one. So both of these things can then throw you for a loop. So if we can go to the next slide, we can extend the roller coaster metaphor even further. There are other twists and curves that make this ride of cancer particularly harrowing. For example, cancer experience, diagnosis and treatment creates a whole cascade of hassles, appointments that interrupt your schedule and your routines, having a surgery and then you can't lift things, going through chemo, then things don't taste right, you don't know what food to buy, your clothes don't fit right, you're tired all the time, you can't do what you're used to be able to doing. Psychological research actually shows that these kinds of hassles, especially when they're stacked up on top of each other, are more closely tied to moods and distress than big events. So furthermore, you're not the only person, or you may not be only a person who's going through these hassles, as other people who are in your life have to adjust along with you. Now, whether that's your spouse, your family, your kids, your coworkers, so even if they're being accommodating and going along, you know, with good cheer and helping you get through this, there can be this collective feeling of strain that, again, is taking you out of the ordinary. Lastly, and sometimes people don't recognize this, that some of the medications that go along with cancer treatment can affect your mood, again, putting you on even more of a roller coaster. For example, going on or stopping steroids, which are sometimes used along with chemotherapy. So you may not even recognize why you're not feeling like yourself. So if we can go to the next slide, please. All of this upheaval then really boils down to feeling like things are out of control. And it's not just a temporary lack of control over until treatment gets over, but it's realizing that our sense of control, the control that we typically have over ourselves, our emotions, and most especially our futures, has always been somewhat fragile. There's sort of an illusory quality. You know, we think we have more, sometimes we think we have more control than we actually do. And cancer has a way of stripping that illusion away. And that can be especially disconcerting. Again, creating that drop in the stomach feeling. Now, next slide, please. So a common reaction then when people are feeling that lack of control is that they then shift to a different image, which you may also recognize, and that's the one of going to war against cancer. So shifting into that battle mind, going to fight it, definitely has advantages. I mean, it's an energizing image, that feeling of rallying the troops, you know, it feels heroic. But that rush of feeling that you're going to get control back may not be sustainable. And it doesn't work as well as an image, or it might even create frustration if you're, say, in a waiting period, you're waiting for test results to come back, or you're facing something that can't be changed. The other issue is that the battle mentality creates this kind of get-it-done mindset where you push your emotions to the side. That's what soldiers do. You know, they put their feelings aside, and it's the mission at all costs. So this can be problematic, especially if you're in the middle of making a big decision, like you're trying to make a treatment decision or trying to decide whether you're going to have a prophylactic procedure. You're in battle mode, say, just get it done, do it. And then you realize that you weren't in touch fully with what it would feel like afterwards to live with the consequences of your decision in the long run. Those emotions that feel distressing may actually also contain important information for you that would inform your decision. Next slide. So another way that people try to regain a sense of control when they feel like they've lost it is to try to control their emotions directly. For example, people may have told you to try to stay positive, that that's what's going to get you through, and to avoid negative thoughts. So hope and optimism are definitely beneficial, but if you're trying to stay positive because you're afraid of having negative thoughts, that they're going to harm you some way, either mentally or physically, then what you're actually doing is living in fear. Right? So other people try to protect themselves by worrying, imagining the worst so that then they don't get let down later. So trying to smooth the roller coaster out by just taking the more negative path, and then you can't be let down. So there's a lot of research in this area as well. It's the technical word for it is metacognition, which is basically your thoughts about your thoughts. So ironically, both worrying about your thoughts and forcing yourself to be positive can be detrimental to you. And it's almost like one phrase I use, it's like trying to control, when you're worrying, it's like trying to control the future with your psychic superpowers. It's not really possible, but yet we cling to that tendency that somehow these worrying thoughts will change how things turn out. Next slide. So if we can't stop the roller coaster, we can't smooth out the kinks, we can't make our minds and our feelings stop doing these loop-de-loops, what can we do? So one way is to ease off of the intensity of that roller coaster feeling is to start seeing your thoughts as passing events, clouds that have shapes and colors, but that have no weight. A phrase that I use when I'm working with patients is lifting up off of the thoughts, allowing just enough of a lift to allow for the possibility of having a different kind of a thought, and to maybe rest in the space between the thoughts. So this image of the passing cloud may be familiar to people who do contemplative practices such as meditation, prayer, yoga. But researchers are finding that this ability to lift off the thoughts is a key ingredient in certain kinds of therapy as well. So if you've experienced cognitive behavioral therapy, it also creates that space where thoughts can be examined and changed and reframed. Next slide, please. So to give an example of what I mean by lifting up off the thought, I was thinking about a grade school student that I was tutoring last summer. And this was a 9-year-old. She was interested in art, so we were reading this children's book on art. We were reading about Matisse and found out that late in his life, he had to lift up off of his self-image as a painter because he had become too ill to paint. So instead, he found a new way to express himself using an assistant's help, and he called this drawing with scissors, making collages. And some of his collages have become some of his most enduring work. So then I turned to my student, Jayla. That's not her real name, but she was. I said, "Okay, let's check this out." And I wanted to give this example just so that you know you don't have to be Matisse. You don't have to be a special person or have some kind of genius to be able to make this shift. So I asked her to imagine what would happen if you broke your arm. Okay, and so she made a list of the things that she wouldn't be able to do and the things that she would still be able to do. For example, she said you couldn't cook as well. It would be harder. You couldn't paint walls. You couldn't play. You couldn't move the arm. You couldn't hang stuff up, or you couldn't do sports. Okay, what could you still do? You could pour water in a cup. That was one of my favorites. You could walk. You could still paint stuff, but it would be different. You could use your phone. You could take a picture. You could read a book. Okay, we've got two nice lists. So how would you feel? How do you feel when you think about what you can't do? Sad. How do you feel when you think about what you can do? Good. There it was. So next slide. In psychology, we call that particular phenomenon the focusing illusion, when what we can't do takes up all of our attention, and what we can still do, which actually may be much greater, is out of focus, and therefore it seems out of reach. It's generally true that people can't imagine being able to adjust to situations, and they can't really predict how they're going to feel until they get there. One of the most consistent findings in health psychology research, actually, is that people going through difficult experiences in general report better quality of life than you might expect. We are flexible. We do adapt. It doesn't happen overnight, but we do get there. Next slide. So how does this happen? You know, is there some kind of special resilience that people have to have? So basically, what it means is redefining what quality of life means to you based on your body and your situation as it is now in the present. So it doesn't mean that you're always going to be this way. So what's possible may shift and shift again as you're making your way through chemo, through surgery, through recovery. So questions that you can ask yourself to bring this process out into the open would be things like asking yourself, what's important to you now? That's reassessing your priorities. You can ask yourself, what's your measure of a good day? When you're healthy, a good day might be the being able to jog for 5 miles. When you're not feeling so well, maybe it's being able to walk down the block and back. But if you recalibrate towards that new goal, you can still feel satisfied within that you're doing what you can. Being able to define, what does quality of life mean to you today? That can also shift from moment to moment. And then asking yourself what you can do, what's going well. So you may have feelings coming up about that. You may feel regrets about your usual definition and having to let that go. But if you can allow those answers to shift and shift again, it gives you the power to create a good enough day out of what you have at hand. So being able to define what's going to make this particular day a good day is a place where you do have control. Next slide. So for those of you who can't see it, the next picture is a picture of a mug that has a phrase that has become very familiar to people, one day at a time. It is familiar to the point of almost losing the meaning of it, but I have never found it to be more true than when dealing with cancer. In real life, doing one day at a time is not that easy. It takes remembering. It's a mental discipline, if you will. But at the same time, it has that lightness that we're talking about, lifting up of thoughts about what the future might be or what you think it should be or that it'll always be this way, and allowing just enough space to make the day doable. Next slide. So there are different ways you can of allowing room to redefine what's going to make a good day. There's multiple things that you can do to get to this shifted perspective, and different people will find different things more or less to their taste. For example, I've already mentioned meditation and yoga. That's one way. cognitive behavioral therapy. Exercise is good not only for your physical health and for lifting your mood, but it also naturally shifts you into a can-do kind of mode because you're active. Another really good technique is expressive writing. There's a researcher, James Pennebaker, who's found that if you write for 15 minutes a day for 3 days in a row about deep personal feelings, so maybe connected to the day that you were diagnosed or some other major event in your life, that if you do that, it has lasting benefits for both your emotions and also your physical health. Lastly, talking to other people, hearing yourself and being heard is also another good way to lift up off the thoughts and get perspective. Next slide. So I can't overemphasize that having good social support during the cancer experience is essential. And it's not so much how many people are in your life who are around you, but having the feeling that you've got at least one person that you can say anything to without being judged. So sometimes you'll have someone who has a lot of family and friends around, but they're holding back because they don't want to worry other people or burden them. But that act of holding back and isolating yourself, that tendency has been shown to lead to more distress and depression in the long run. So that can really spiral back out of control, ironically, when you're trying to control the level of worry and distress that you and other people are feeling. Next slide. So I want to leave you with some food for thought that you can take with you. So cancer can be like a roller coaster, and we've seen some ways in which the image really holds true. Cancer also can be like a battle, and that image also has benefits. But you're not bound by any of these images unless you find that they serve you, right? Roller coasters are scary. Battles are heroic. Both oddly have that quality of being vividly alive in the moment, right? So you can have these images and maybe examine to what extent does this image speak your truth? And if it doesn't feel like it's capturing everything, you can allow other images to come to you. So you want to ask yourself, whatever image you're having about what your cancer experience is like, does it speak your truth? Does it empower you? Does it comfort you? Right? A battle image or a roller coaster image doesn't offer comfort. Right? And does it connect you to other people? Next slide. I want to say then you can also ask yourself about your beliefs about worries. What are your beliefs about the thoughts and feelings that you're having? Are you censoring your negative thoughts? Are you fearful of your thoughts and feelings? Or do you feel like you can't stop dwelling on them? Right? So it's basically looking at your relationship to your thoughts, but even more so, what is your relationship to your worried self, your distressed self? Next slide. So in short, trying to stop the roller coaster and to get away from all the ups and downs of your feelings can essentially be like trying to get away from yourself. So I can't promise that you won't have intense feelings or disappointments, that things are not always going to go the way that you hope as you're moving through treatment, but you can stay open to what's possible. It's not easy, but it has to be just doable enough. You do have control about how you relate to your thoughts, to all of your thoughts, and to offer every thought that comes to you an equal amount of compassion. This is this open, compassionate feeling towards your own experience can help you move towards living fully and well right in the middle of treatment, right in the middle of your survivorship, so that you're not grimly trying to hang on till the end of the ride when you can then climb off and get back to your real life, but right now when you need the best of yourself the most.
So I will close there and turn the program over to our next speaker. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Hurley. I love that you ended on a slide talking about compassionate, because you gave such a clear and compassionate overview of some of the issues that many women on today's call are facing after a cancer diagnosis. I think that your takeaways certainly apply to survivorship, and your presentation is a great springboard to discuss the issues of breast cancer and ovarian cancer survivors, including those living with advanced breast cancer or ovarian cancer. I'm not going to go through my bio, but I think that it's enough to say that I've been at Sharsheric for over 10 years, and much of what I'm going to present this evening comes from the hard-earned wisdom of the women that I speak to on a daily basis. So our survivorship program actually came out of feedback that we've received from many callers who will say things like this. You know, when I was first diagnosed, it was tough. You know, it sort of was like a punch in the stomach. But okay, I got myself together and I got my treatment team together. I made my treatment and surgical decisions and I was okay. And I went through surgery and it was hard to rally again, but okay, I was okay. What? Now I have to undergo treatment, and the thought is, you know, how do I dig deep again to find that strength? But okay, I did it. So, and I was okay. But now it's 6 months later, for some 2 years later, for some 5 years later, and they say, you know, I was basically okay, but it's hitting me now. And I think the way that I look at it is that I think that we're not wired to take a hit physically and emotionally at the same time, because we really wouldn't be able to function. So I think what ends up happening as the body is undergoing surgery and treatment and is recovering and healing, the psyche is sort of off to the side tapping its watch, right? And when the treatment is over, the psyche says to the body, are you done? And the body says, yeah, I'm all done. And the psyche says, well, good, it's my turn. And I think it's at that point that many women that I've spoken to are feeling like they're only now digesting that they went through cancer or they had surgery because they were at high risk for hereditary cancer. And they look back and they said, what? Was this my life? So I think that that's why it hits often after the medical piece. The problem I find for many women is that the people in their life, their family and their friends, they want to sort of wrap up cancer in a box with a pretty pink ribbon or with a teal ribbon, and they say, okay, you're done. Fine, let's move on, and everything will go back to the same. The problem is that cancer survivorship, we're dealing with a chronic diagnosis of advanced cancer, doesn't get wrapped up so neatly. It's here that we see a difference in how our loved ones see survivorship versus those of you who are facing survivorship yourselves. The other problem that we see is that looks are deceiving. So, you know, for many of you, you may start looking like your old self, and you may be looking healthier, and you may have more energy, but that doesn't necessarily match your insides. And so looks are deceiving, where people just look at you and they assume, well, you must be fine again because you look good and your energy is good and you're active again. But again, they don't really understand that internally you are now starting to deal with some of the issues that are unique to those who are surviving cancer. I think that, you know, we often hear, and I'm sure many of you have heard the expression, the new normal. Right, and I think that really what happens after a cancer diagnosis, or again, if you find out that you are a carrier of the BRCA mutation, that it really does change your emotional DNA forever. You know, I think when we use the expression new normal, that's what it's referring to. Although I did have one woman who said that she wasn't so unhappy with the old normal, and she wasn't looking to change, and she wasn't necessarily looking for a new normal. I think for many people, what we are seeing is that the way that their emotional DNA changes is that they may become more magnified versions of themselves prior to diagnosis. So, you know, if we're seeing somebody who tends to be a worrier, you know, we may see that a little bit more exaggerated. If we see somebody who's a doer or, you know, needs to be in control, that may be a little bit more exaggerated. And the same thing with, you know, let's say anxiety. Not always. You know, sometimes people either give up being a worrier or feeling anxious. Some people now take it on. But I think overall we see that maybe people become somewhat of a more magnified version of themselves. The dilemma that we often see, I think, for those who for the issues that Dr. Hurley was describing, we're also seeing in survivorship, and that once somebody faces a diagnosis, there is a tendency to see everything through the cancer glasses. Right, so probably the most obvious is when we talk about fear of recurrence, right? So every ache and pain, you know, I think that women are more aware of and more concerned about. So it could just be that they maybe have a back spasm from lifting up something too heavy, but the immediate thought is, huh, I wonder if this is the cancer back again. For those of you on the call who are living with a metastatic breast cancer or advanced ovarian cancer, again, you know, every ache and pain may be a worry that perhaps the disease is progressing. You know, it's hard not to see everything through these cancer glasses. I remember one woman sharing a story that, you know, she was so grateful to have transitioned into survivorship, and she was going to her son's graduation from kindergarten, and she forced her whole family to get there several hours early, and they had to be in the front row, and her thought was, you know, like, thank God I made it here, and, you know, and I want to be, you know, as present as possible. But what ended up happening is that this thought, because of the cancer glasses, associating it with the graduation, was that she ended up feeling more stressed out, and the family ended up feeling more stressed out. And, you know, I think that clearly her cancer experience influenced these kind of events. I think that we can't talk about the emotional impact without talking about loss. And I think that there are probably many losses that those of you on the call may experience. So, you know, certainly I think people lose a trust in their body, right, that somehow their body let them down, and how can they ever really trust that that can't happen again? Certainly, they, you know, many women are reporting that they have either changed in relationships or that they've lost relationships and have been disappointed with how people were not able to be of support. You know, I think those of you who are moms on the call, I think that there is a sense perhaps of losing the child, you know, your children's innocence now having to deal with such a serious diagnosis. For some of you, not being able to get pregnant or breastfeed, for those of you who observe the mitzvah of the mikvah, which is the Jewish ritual bath ceremony, perhaps due to either temporary or permanent menopause as a result of surgery or treatment, not being able to do that. I think that there's certainly a change and for some a loss of sexuality and a loss of, you know, a sense of self and who are you and your self-image. You know, we get many phone calls from women who talk about the loss of financial stability. We hear people talking about the loss of, you know, how they dreamed their life would unfold. And again, there's that innocence that is taken away. And I think one that we do hear about consistently is that there is, when for those of you who are finished with treatment, that there is a sense of a loss of a safety net of not being seen by a doctor as regularly as when you were seen when you were undergoing surgery and treatment. So those were the losses. But I also think that there could be a lot of things that were found. Many, many, many women, in fact, probably most of the women that we speak with here at Church Ferret, we see that there's an incredible resiliency, an inner strength that many of you didn't know that you even had. Because why would you need that? And, you know, I think that there's a quote out there that says you never know how strong you are until having strength is your only choice. I think that for many women, they have clarity in relationships. They may be taking a second look at the people in their lives. They may be taking a second look at the priorities in their lives. I think that women have found a great sense of humor when dealing with this. Many women have become incredibly resourceful, and not just in the area of breast cancer or ovarian cancer, but I think that sense of needing to be resourceful can apply and be adapted to many different situations in your life. I think, you know, for the children, you know, I believe that it really gives an opportunity for children to learn the tools of coping in life. I myself was a young teenager when my mom was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, and the message is we are going to face this as a family, and that this isn't going to break us. And that I think that as a result of that attitude, my brothers and me, that we are really able to face adversity and challenges in our life with a tremendous inner resources and tools. So what's next? Survivorship is uncharted waters for each of you, and this in itself can raise anxiety. So whether you are finished with treatment or you're still undergoing treatment, the fight has been challenging and in many cases difficult. It's important to remember to live the life that you have fought so hard to live. And one of the things that I think could be helpful for those of you who are transitioning into survivorship is to maybe come up with a mission statement for yourselves, right? Decide what is important to you and then come up with objectives to meet that mission statement. And, you know, I think you can break it down. What do you want to achieve on a daily basis? What would you like to achieve on a weekly basis, a monthly basis, a yearly basis? And I think by setting up a mission statement with these objectives, that it really is a more manageable way of facing your future. And clearly, the mission statement can be adjusted, as can the objectives. I often describe survivorship as a volume control knob on a stereo, right, where sometimes the volume of anxiety goes up really high, right? So when you have to maybe go up for follow-up appointments, whether it's screenings or doctor's appointments, or you're waiting for results of these tests, that the volume goes up really loud. But I would say for the most part that I find that women are able to live comfortably with the volume as background noise, where there's always that reminder that you had a cancer diagnosis or, again, are at high risk for a cancer diagnosis. But that there are other things that come to the forefront, you know, taking care of your families, taking care of work responsibilities. So I find that most people are able to live with it as background noise. And I often joke with women that I've spoken to that I have never spoken with a woman who's actually figured out how to turn the volume control knob off completely, but that if she is the one who figures it out, we're going on Oprah and making our millions. I think similar to what Dr. Hurley was saying, that it is important to embrace your emotions and to embrace the triggers. And triggers really come in a range of intensity. For some women, they've described it even as, you know, from a mild post-traumatic stress disorder. Some people say that they feel a more severe post-traumatic stress disorder. Some women don't see it as that and maybe just simply see it as a trigger. So what I would often recommend is imagine that somebody is standing by your side and you put your arm around them and you bring them closer. I think that's what you should do with the triggers, to sort of put your arm around it and say, "Oh, right, I knew you were coming. I was expecting you. You can stay and hang out, but we have things to do." And I think that the more that you embrace these triggers, the less energy that it takes to sort of fight these triggers off, similar to what Dr. Hurley was mentioning earlier. Also, not everything is about cancer, and it is important to find cancer-free zones. So what could that look like? What's an example? So, you know, sometimes when you read the newspaper or you see on social media a story about cancer, if you know that historically this has been a trigger for you, don't read it. That should be a cancer-free zone. If people start talking to you about your cancer experience and you don't want to talk about it, then you need to say, listen, you know, I am not interested in talking about that. You know, I'm out, I'm shopping, or I'm at some sort of wedding or a party, and this is a cancer-free zone for me, so I would really rather not talk about that. And I really want to empower you to be able to take care of yourself in that way and to have cancer-free zones. It's also important to explore your options. So, you know, earlier I talked about fertility and adoption. So, you know, if that's something that is on your radar screen for your future, you may need to add those experts in that field onto your treatment team. So you may be adding a fertility specialist if you already haven't. You may be adding a social worker or a psychiatrist. You know, you may be deciding, like, you know what, now that I'm dealing with this, it's feeling too much. I may need to go into therapy. Maybe medication will be helpful. And again, it's not all or nothing, and it's not necessarily permanent. But again, to explore the possibilities, you can maybe get involved in advocacy. Maybe this is a time, now that you're taking a second look at your life, to explore new hobbies or interests. And certainly another thing that you can do is for the support that you've received, you can pay it forward, either to people in your community. Certainly, you know, we love having the women who were once callers become peer supporters for other women calling into Sharsharet. It's important to find your voice. This is not a time to test relationships. Certainly, people cannot be mind readers, you know, either whether it's family members or friends. So it's important to be clear about what your needs are. And what I have found, actually having spoken with many friends and families members, is that it's a relief to them to know clearly what the needs are, and to understand what you are going through, even in survivorship, so that they can better adjust how they are going to interact with you, because no two people respond the same way. So we can't fault people for not knowing the right thing to say, and that it's important to openly communicate so that ultimately you can get your needs met. I also think that it's important to figure out what your takeaways were from this experience. What's your learning curve? You know, apply what you've learned through this experience and try, as I said earlier, to maybe adapt it to other circumstances and other situations. You know, I think it would be a shame to go through this and not come out having learned something about yourself and about maybe doing things differently in your life. Okay, and I wanted to put the slide up here because we have a kit that is personalized for those of you who are survivors or, again, including those living with advanced cancer. And you can tailor this kit to meet your unique needs and to address the unique issues that you are facing. So I want to encourage all of you to come to the Sharsharit website, and you can order this for free, and you know, you can do that on the website. Also, I mentioned earlier that you yourself can pay it forward and become a peer supporter, but we also have peer supporters who do address survivorship issues. So if you find yourself struggling with a particular issue, give us a call and we will find you a peer supporter. And it's not uncommon for peer supporters to have their own peer support. So, you know, certainly be in touch with us in the office and we can make that match for you. I am now going to hand over the teleconference to Abby. She is a Sharsharit cancer survivor, and she's going to share her personal story about navigating the emotional impact of cancer. Abby?
Hi. Thanks, Shira. Okay. In order to explain the process I went through in dealing with the emotional aspect of a cancer diagnosis and treatment, I think it's important to understand where I was coming from. For me, everything I knew about cancer came from the movies. I'd seen Terms of Endearment and Steel Magnolias and like Stepmom, but my cancer was unscripted. It was literally that roller coaster that you were talking about, totally blindsiding me every step of the way. Even my diagnosis was backwards. I found out I had cancer after the mastectomy, not before. But even with the surprises that jumped out at every doctor visit and during every phone call, I still felt on top of the situation. I had Google, I had Sharsharit, I had family. It was pretty much fine. It was actually over a month after my surgery, while I was going through reconstruction, that I found myself really floundering. I had a good prognosis, and eventually, with medication, I would recover. I was, like I said before, fine. But for some reason, after I no longer needed pain medication, after I was driving and making meals and returning back to real life, a cloud moved in, settling over my head permanently. I couldn't understand what was wrong with me. I was up all night, staring at the ceiling, writing on my blog, wondering where the insomnia was coming from. At one point, I drove around at around 3 in the morning, stopping in a parking lot simply to sit there and sob. Intellectually, I knew what was happening made no sense. There was no reason to be upset. After all, there were so many worse cases than mine, so many women with worse prognoses. I shouldn't really complain. And the more I knew that, the worse I became, adding guilt to that mix. Still, I thought it was just me, that I was crazy. I spoke to a friend who comforted me by telling me that I had a right to be crazy. Not that that helped at all. If anything, it made it worse, because now my insanity had this magical seal of approval. I still didn't put a name to what was happening. I couldn't call it depression, because in my mind, that didn't make sense. How can I possibly be depressed? I was alive. I had no right to be depressed, my friend's advice notwithstanding. I kept up a really good front, but I knew I was falling apart. In fact, when Robin Williams committed suicide that summer, I told my husband that I could understand that. Not that I was suicidal, but I understood the desperation. It was what I was feeling on a constant basis. I battled this all summer. When it came time for my second surgery, I went to the doctor for a pre-op visit and broke down in her office. I told her I was crying all the time, that I wasn't sleeping, that I couldn't shake whatever it was, and she gave me some antidepressants. I took the prescription but didn't fill it, mainly because I was not that person. I didn't want to be that person. And again, logically, it made no sense. Later that week, I was at a wedding, and a friend from my community came to my table. She was a breast cancer survivor. I must have looked terrible. I know I felt pretty awful. I was sitting at the table by myself, not talking to anyone. So she spoke to me, told me about her treatment, about the meds she takes, and she said every day she takes what she calls her little happy pill. And I was shocked. I spoke to my link, the person Sharshara connected me with, and when I mentioned that I was given a prescription for antidepressants, she laughed and said that she was on the British version of the same thing. Slowly, I discovered that depression and breast cancer, probably any cancer for that matter, go hand in hand. Like so many other stages of my diagnosis and treatment, this was, again, one I did not anticipate, the one that completely blindsided me. Perhaps it was because no one ever talks about that part. No one wants to see the residual pain that tends to creep up long after everyone else has packed up cancer into that neat little box that Shira described and stamped it with the done stamp. I modified my Google search and found story after story of depression after cancer, depression from tamoxifen, depression from PTSD, from a mastectomy. It was the silent side effect no one talked about or wanted to deal with. For me, it was the final betrayal. I'd been betrayed by my body, and now here was this condition that I could not intellectualize. There was no logic. It was clinical in nature and required treatment, treatment that for me involved antidepressants and medication. My mother wouldn't hear of it. She just told me to cheer up. It really took speaking to other women to understand that this was a common step, a step that was, for the most part, curable. It's interesting that breast cancer for me felt celebrated everywhere. October was a nightmare with pink banners and smiling cheerleaders on every corner, and everyone and their brothers wore ribbons in solidarity. There was so much about surgery and scars and being strong, but there was silence in regards to this. I found it alone, embarrassed to tell people to reach out, guilty that I was feeling this way. It was a part of cancer that I didn't see in the movies and didn't read in the books. That's tragic because there is help. There are things that can be done. I'm no longer on antidepressants. I took them religiously for almost a year and then tried my luck without them. And so far, it's been good. I've spoken to other women, and I tell them what Shira said, but what she said just before. You spend so much time dealing with the physical pain of surgery and treatment that your emotions do kind of sit on the sidelines. And once you start feeling stronger, it's like they show up and say, hi, I'm here, you know, I'm taking over. And everything hits you like a ton of bricks out of the blue. It's normal, but it can get bad. And that's why knowing it's normal is not enough. I'm glad I found the support, but I wish I had known how many women needed that extra help beyond yoga or exercise or a diet. I wish I'd known that it wasn't a stigma, it wasn't a badge of shame, a you can't handle this kind of thing. It simply is what it is. Knowing that and doing something about it makes all the difference. And for me, I'm glad that I knew that.
Abby, thank you very much. I want to mention here that Abby had shared this with me, and this her story was really the impetus to us wanting to address this issue in a teleconference. So thank you for sharing your story. We are now going to just take a few questions, and you can do so by dialing *1, and questions will be addressed in the order that they are received. I do want to mention that we will be offering an Ask the Expert session in the upcoming weeks following this webinar, and that all of you are invited to submit any additional questions that we may not get to tonight via email, and that I and Dr. Hurley will respond to these questions in an Ask the Expert blog post, which will be posted on our website. So I ask that you keep your questions broad in nature so that everyone can benefit from the discussion. So we did get one question, Dr. Hurley, that came in, which is, my sister was recently diagnosed with breast cancer. How can I best support her in terms of the emotional impact?
Okay, it's a great question. So my suggestion would be to follow her lead because, you know, as the emotions are shifting from day to day, you know, and the tasks, you know, the challenges are shifting from day to day. You know, I'm a survivor myself, and I found that the friends who were able to track with my moods, so when I needed someone to listen and be serious, when I had tears, that was helpful. And then maybe a few minutes later I felt better and then cracked a joke, and then they were able to shift with me and start laughing. Right? And they didn't think that either of those states were normal. So just to, you know, sort of take It's a little bit like, you know, being a good follower in a couple's dance, is to just slow down when she needs to slow down, distract when she's asking for distraction, and to give a compassionate presence that doesn't have that pitying look, like, oh, are you okay? But rather, hey, I'm here. How can I be with you now where you are?
And I just actually want to add to what Dr. Hurley said, and that is a lot of times people try to always find the right thing to say. And one of the things that I've learned from women is don't work so hard. You don't have to work so hard to say the right thing. I think sometimes it's just enough to say, whatever it is, I'm with you. Another question that came in is, what are recommendations for explaining the emotional side effects to family and friends? So I'm wondering, Abby, if you want to take that.
Well, I think when you had said, you know, that whole idea, well, everybody really wants everything to be done. Like, everybody kind of looks at you and says, okay, you're fine. Understanding what happens after, for me, when I had to explain it to my husband, when he couldn't really understand why I was so depressed or why I was, you know, struggling with this, I really used the example that you had given, which is how, you know, that I was dealing with all the physical aspects of it and trooping along and putting up this front for my family, for my kids, for everybody. And then, but the emotional aspect was hitting me constantly on a daily basis. And when I put it in that perspective for him, he kind of understood that. He kind of got that logical explanation for it. Even though, like I said, there was no real logic at play. I couldn't intellectualize it away. But understanding that the emotional part was coming later, that it was coming now, was easier for him to understand. And I think that helped, you know, even with my close friends, when I explained that, they were able to understand that.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Hurley, we got a question from a 39-year-old who was diagnosed, and she has a young daughter. She wants some maybe suggestions on how to approach the issue of health without sending her on an emotional roller coaster.
Okay, yeah. So first of all, I thought that your comments about, you know, losing the innocence worrying about children losing their innocence as they're witnessing you going through treatment, I thought that was spot on. You know, sometimes women will feel like they're doing something to their children by having cancer, essentially blaming themselves. Right. So I think that one thing that we can that may be helpful is to trust in children's resilience, right? To support them in that they're looking to you to, you know, learn life lessons. Like, well, what is it like when you have something that's hard to do? What is it like when you have feelings, right? We don't have to protect the children from those, but rather support them in being able to understand it in a way that's more easily digested for them. There are lots of good resources out there for how to talk to children about cancer, and you might be able to point these out to people. But I think trusting if we're having, learning what our strengths are, to trust that the children are having that parallel experience at their developmental level.
Yeah, and again, I would also add to that is that, you know, you are going to set the tone, that oftentimes children are going to look to you to see how to deal with this, and they may be taking some social cues in terms of how to manage this. So, you know, I think that you can certainly decide for yourself what's the message that you want to give to your children, and certainly when we're talking about health, that a message can be, look, you know, I'm taking care of my health, I'm being responsible, and that's not something we should be afraid of. It's actually a good thing, and I've gotten people who are on my treatment team who know me and who are going to take care of me. So again, I think that it can just be reframed for children. Dr. Hurley, we have one last question, and I'm going to just broaden it a little bit because it talks a little bit about losing hair, but I think just in terms of change in body image, whether it's hair or scars from surgery, that it may be raising anxiety because it's a constant reminder of the cancer experience. So perhaps we can end on this question if you wouldn't mind addressing that.
Sure. Well, I think that one thing that's important to remember is that there's what your body looks like now and then what you think that means. Like sometimes, you know, you'll hear people talking about, you know, the hair loss of chemo and saying, oh, you're losing a sign of femininity, right? And where in truth, you know, we inhabit women's bodies, and so therefore we get to define what our femininity, what our womanhood is. So to the extent that you can give compassion and attention and embrace your body in the moment and what's happening to it, you know, instead of, you know, you can, you know, grieve the loss of your hair, but then rub your bald head. You know, what does it feel like to have this head, this skin? You know, and whatever it else it is. So one of the images is, so after I had my mastectomy and had the implant, is that I call my my implant the new girl, right? So thinking about the image of, you know, if there's a new girl coming into a classroom, you want to make her feel welcome. So I was trying to make the implant feel welcome, as this is my body as it is now. So, you know, that was a spontaneous image for me. So, you know, allowing a spontaneous image that lets you embrace and comfort your body as it is now, I think is tremendously important.
Yes, I agree. Thank you, Dr. Hurley. I just want to remind all of you that there will be more opportunities for questions via the Ask the Experts, and questions can be sent to ShiraKravitz@ShoreSherritt.org, and more information will follow. Your feedback is very important to us. Much of what we do here at ShoreSherritt and teleconferences that we do really come from you. And so please complete the online evaluation that will be sent to you. There will be a transcript and audio available, and you'll be able to access the transcript and audio of the webinar at www.sharsherritt.org, #resources #transcripts. And if you're having problems finding it, certainly call the office, and we can send you a link to this transcript and audio. I want to again thank the Julius and Emmy Hamburger Memorial Fund for generously supporting tonight's program, and to thank both Dr. Hurley and Abby for your insight and clarity on these issues. Stay connected with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure, my pleasure, our pleasure. Stay connected. You can call us at 866-474-2774. You can reach out to us on info@sharsherritt.org or go to our website, www.sharsherritt.org. And I want to say that if you haven't already had an opportunity to see our videos, either on our website or on YouTube, it really does, these videos are words of inspiration from other women who have faced either a cancer diagnosis or at risk for hereditary cancer. And I think that a lot of their words will both be will resonate with you and also give you a hopeful message. So thank you for joining us, and we want to wish all of you a good night.